Welcome to ClassicSinai.com. The class you're about to hear is one of 26 free, all-star Jewish classics available to help you live a more vibrant, meaningful, and fulfilling life.
The other night I was putting my children to bed, so I was reading them a story before bed, and I read them the story of Sleeping Beauty. So I pointed out that when the prince falls in love with Sleeping Beauty, she's sleeping, right? He doesn't know anything about her goals in life. He doesn't know anything about her character. He doesn't know anything about her whatsoever. She just knows she's beautiful, right? She wakes up. She sees him. She doesn't know anything about his goals in life, anything about his character. She just knows he's charming. They live happily ever after, right? That's a fairy tale. Now, we all know how the fairy tale really ends, right? They're married for a little while. The initial ardor wears off. She starts having an affair with her polo teacher, right? You know, he starts having an affair with someone else. They have a sordid divorce, and she dies in a fiery car crash with an Arab movie maker, right? That's how the fairy tale really ends. But, unsurprisingly, people raised on fairy tales wind up believing them and living according with what they teach. So I find that you ask the average guy, what are you looking for in a woman you're going to spend your life with? So he says to me, well, she should be attractive, right? Then he says, well, that's not the most important thing to me. You know, he mentioned it first, right? But it wasn't the most important thing to him, right? He says, she should be attractive and nice. I say, okay, that's certainly revealing. Okay, and so I asked the woman, well, what is it you're looking for? Said, well, he should be successful. Not that that's most important. You know, she mentioned it first, but it's not necessarily most important. Right? He should be successful and nice, right? So, you know, I point out, you know, nice is an excellent qualification if the job is to be the doorman. And that's like, you know, when you're looking for a doorman for a classy hotel, you want someone who's nice. Good morning, sir. How are you? Nice to. But nice is pretty shallow, right? Someone you're going to spend a life with, you want something that goes a little deeper than that. You want an aspect of character that is somewhat more significant. I would suggest as a shopping list, for example, you got to find someone who's not only nice but kind. Nice is good manners. But kind means unselfish. Kind means genuinely interested in someone else. It's your fulfillment. It's your realization as a human being. It's the achievement of your goals that's significant to me, not only my own. Kind is much more rare than nice. You need to find someone who's loyal, has a sense of loyalty. You know, the marriage is an enormously difficult thing to sustain, particularly in a world in which it's becoming less and less common, long-lasting marriages. So I give as a metaphor for the appropriate commitment of marriage, the commitment that you make to your hand. Now, this hand of mine, I'm pretty committed to it, actually. You know, we've been together for a long time, and I'm actually very committed to this hand. Now, it's not unshakable. You know, and if the doctor would say to me, Nachum, you have gangrene, and I'm afraid to tell you that unless we take your hand, you're going to die, I'd say, well, okay. I've been with this hand a long while, and I'm very committed to it, but between dying and giving up the hand, you can have the hand, right? But it would have to be about that serious. Right? If the doctor said to me, you know, Nachum, that's not a very attractive hand you have there. You know, and I've seen someone with nicer hands than yours. Or, I would say to myself, you know, when I was a young child and I looked at this hand, it was just, ha ha, I laughed when I saw it. It was fun for a day to have a hand and to laugh. And then I would look at it and I would play with the fingers. And now it's just a hand to me, so I'm thinking of amputating it. He'd say, man's out of his mind, right? And I'd say, unless you go into marriage with a commitment that this is like the commitment to my hand, you get divorced. It's inevitable. It's inevitable because marriage, I say, is extremely difficult. There comes in every marriage, and the greatest marriage that ever was, is this moment, you know, you stand there, you're looking at your wife, and you stand in the living room, and you look at her, and you say to yourself, this woman is crazy. Right? She's out of her mind. She's irrational. How can anyone have a reasonable conversation with a person? In every marriage, that moment comes. Now, so you have one of two choices. That one choice is you go, oh, forget it, you bag it, let's try again. You do the same thing over again. You look for another princess to kiss. And the other choice is you say, she's nuts. Most likely I'm also nuts. Right? You take a deep breath. Oh, you say, okay, let's try it again. Explain to me again. Yeah. That's commitment. You see, and it highlights a very important Jewish distinction, the distinction between comfort and pleasure. Comfort is I have no pain. Going to sleep is comfortable. Lying down on the beach in the Bahamas is comfortable. You know, like that moment, you're, like, you're almost asleep. You don't want to be completely asleep. I want you completely asleep. You might as well be in the Bronx. You want to be almost asleep. Just, that's comfortable. But the really significant things in life are not comfortable. Marriage is not comfortable. Raising children is not comfortable. Being successful, the work that matters to you is not comfortable. Pleasurable, deeply rewarding, but not comfortable. If you go into marriage expecting comfort, expecting it to be easy, it's inevitable you get divorced. So you got to find someone who's kind, as opposed to merely nice. You got to find someone who has a sense of what loyalty is about. You need to find someone who's honest. Honest means a certain amount of self-awareness, a certain willingness to be forthcoming. You need to find someone whose goals in life are consistent with your own. I give us a definition of marriage. It's the commitment we make to pursue together our goals in living. Which means you have to have goals in living. You got to find someone else with goals in living. They have to match. Marriage itself is not a life goal. Another illusion that fairy tales sell us is that if you're truly in love, it answers all life's questions. You have no existential needs. You never have a sense of anxiety, of uncertainty, of loneliness, of meaninglessness. It's completely untrue. Marriage is not a goal in life. Marriage is an expansion of who you are. It's an expansion of your understanding, of your depth as a human being, of the way in which you can engage with the world and learn from it and create within it. But you have to have a sense of goal and a purpose that goes beyond yourself. This is sort of a thumbnail sketch of what I take to be a Jewish understanding of what is this beast called marriage. It's the commitment we make to pursue together our goals in life. You got to find someone who's not merely attractive and nice, but kind and honest and loyal and has a sense of purpose in their life. Now, I find when I do counseling, people come in, you know, and I feel like I'm one of those tow trucks that's like called to the scene of an accident. You go, like, how did this happen exactly? I mean, not only how did you get this, but why exactly did you two get married? I don't know. It just sort of happened. I was going this way in the 405, and I meant to turn this way, and she came around the turn without looking, and then. We were married. I mean, I don't know. We were sort of like involved. And like she said, if you want to make a commitment, I'm leaving. And again, next thing I knew is like, here we were. And again, so for a number of reasons, I want to suggest to you that if you want to have a lasting relationship with someone, one of the most important things you can do is to make sure that you don't begin by falling in love. Okay? You see, when people say they're in love, a guy comes in and he says to me, oh, Rabbi, I'm in love. I say, that's wonderful. Tell me about this woman. What are her goals in living? He says, that is a great question. I say, okay, is she a kind person? He says, you're on a roll. I got to write these down. I say, is she honest? And he says, where do you get these insights from? I don't know. I got to find out. I say, tell me, my friend, what is it about this woman you love? I mean, you don't know anything about her. It's like saying, you see this book? I love it. I haven't read it, but I love it. It has such a beautiful cover. Is that a great cover? I'm in love with this book. So how does this happen? The most common way it happens, of course, is people become emotionally and sexually involved very, very rapidly. See, the way we date in America is like this. We go out and we sit together in a movie. Now, that's a good place to go on a date because we don't talk to each other. Right? And it guarantees we'll learn nothing about each other. Right? We'll sit there in the dark, we won't speak, and we'll watch some piece of entertainment outside of ourselves. And then after, we'll have a fairly trivial conversation about the movie or about acting. I mean, nothing that really is too terribly revealing either about ourselves or about the other person. We do that a few times. And then we go to bed. Now, at that point, all talking stops completely. Right? He says, just shut up, okay? Just, you know, you're gonna ruin it. Just, you know. And whatever energy there might be, just go and get split. So people are together for a fairly long time. They know nothing about each other. Nothing. You know, I have this book. It's called Nice Guys Sleep Alone. And on the cover, it's a picture of this couple, and they're passionately kissing, and the woman is thinking, gee, this is wonderful. We should have lunch sometime. Yeah. So there are a couple of reasons I want to suggest to you why, for self-interest, it's a very, very good idea. Sex belongs in marriage. Number one, as I'm saying, what really determines whether a relationship has got a long-term possibility is character, is goals. Now, when you become sexually involved with someone, you're committed. You have an enormous investment in the future of this relationship. And at that point, examining with any kind of objectivity, who is this person? What am I doing here? Is this something I want to be part of? Does this make sense? It's very, very difficult. I mean, it's like, you know, you take all your money, you put it in an investment, and then you say, now let me read the prospectus. Yeah, what did I just invest in? You go, oh my gosh. I mean, like, at that point, it's a little late. You're invested. That's one reason. That's the second reason. The second reason is, you see, sex is an aspect of our language as human beings. It's the way in which we create intimacy and commitment. Now, when you become sexually involved with someone where that commitment doesn't exist, you're going to get hurt. I mean, it's just inevitable. I mean, it's as though, you know, you put yourself out there and you make yourself vulnerable, you make yourself exposed, you say, I'm anticipating this. And when it isn't forthcoming, you're going to get hurt. Right? Guy comes to me and says, oh, Nachum, I'm in love, and, you know, we spent the day on the beach, and we laughed, and it was so easy, and I knew I was in love. You know, next week she won't return his phone calls, right? Right? But for the moment he's in love, you're going to get hurt. Now, you get hurt once, twice, three, you get hurt often enough, you become calloused. Which is to say, you stop believing that people mean what they say. You stop believing in the possibility, and you stop believing in other people's goodness, their generosity, their kindness, their disinterested concern for you. You know, there's a tremendous difference between singles in their, let's say, their early 20s and singles in their mid to late 30s. I mean, there's something painful that becomes lost there. There's something that's become calloused and hardened. Because we've become hurt, we've been hurt over and over, and it's damaging. It's damaging to ourself. It's another reason why it's a good idea to hold sex until marriage. I'll give you another reason. You know, when my first child was born, I was trying to describe to someone what that experience was like of watching a child being born. So I said, you know, it was stunning. I mean, anyone who's ever had a child or seen a child in the morning, anyone who's ever been a child, I mean, maybe you probably don't remember your own birth, but I mean, anyone who's ever, you know, been at a, it is astonishing, shocking, beyond anything that you can possibly grasp. I mean, when my first child was born, the sense of emotion that was so overwhelming, I thought I was going to explode. I mean, it was as though, you know, you try and feed more current through something than it can carry. So I was trying to describe the experience to someone, and I said, it was really stunning. But the problem is, I'd used the word stunning to describe so many things that weren't stunning, that it didn't mean anything to call the birth of a child stunning. I said, you know, it was like having my first child. It was a pleasant experience. I mean, you know, I hadn't said anything, but I didn't have any other words to use. I'd used up my vocabulary, so I was mute. I had no way of sharing this experience. Now, there's going to come, please God, in everyone's life, a moment you're going to want to say to someone, "I love you," in a way, with an intimacy, with a commitment, with a completeness of who I am that goes beyond anything I've ever felt for another human being before, and this is forever. Now, how will you say that? How will you communicate that? Sex is part of our language. It's part of the way in which we communicate. And if you misuse the language, then it isn't available to serve you when you need it. And it makes you mute. And that means a a loss in your ability to communicate, to give to another person the depth of what you want to share with them. These are some of the reasons why certain traditional Jewish understanding, if you want to have a lasting relationship with someone, a marriage is going to last you a lifetime and nurture you, that you're going to grow with and grow from. And I point out of this is that a marriage, silly people, foolish people believe that at the wedding day, this is the greatest day ever. I tell them, you don't have a clue. This is a hint of what there is. I mean, it's like you smell the food, you go, it's just a whiff. Because, at a marriage, you feel a sense of promise, you feel a sense of opportunity, you feel a sense of new beginning. I mean, and just the hint of what is the joy of what two people can bring to each other. But the real realization of that, the fruition of that, is a lifetime of work. And it's continually deepening and growing, and the joy that you have in a partner after 5 years, after 10 years, after 15 years, after 20 years. You think you even have a clue of what that is when you stand there under the wedding canopy? You're just hoping and dreaming. When people say this is the best day ever, it's a sad thing. It means that, from this moment comes that process of unfortunate awakening to the reality not being, to the fairy tale, that it's been a fairy tale. But that's because we live our lives in fairy tales. If we go into a marriage, not beginning by falling in love and becoming infatuated because she's beautiful and he's charming, but by saying, what is there more deep here? There's kindness, there's honesty, there's loyalty, there's shared goals. I contrast, being infatuated, which, as I say, is really a lot to do with desire, and very little to do with real love. Love is two pieces of insight. One is, the Jewish understanding is, love is the pleasure you take in another person's, in their humanity, in their good, in their character. The pleasure you see that in them. You see their idealism. You see their generosity. You see their kindness. It's beautiful. That's love. That's not available when you don't know someone. That's not available when all you see is the pretty wrapping paper. And more than that, I've made before the point that the world believes we love people when they give to us. The reality is, people give me a great deal. I don't love them, I resent them. Kirk Douglas, the actor, used to tell me, he would say to people, I'll lend you money, but on one condition: if you can't repay me, just don't hate me. Because if I do you a favor and you can't reciprocate, or you can't, you breed resentment. That's why it's so difficult to get along with our parents. Not because they don't give us enough, it's because they've given us too much. It's bred such a sense of indebtedness and it's burdensome, and I can't return. I have to reject them as a way of freeing myself from that terrible sense of obligation. Being given to doesn't breed love. Giving breeds love. I give to you, you become important to me. That's why we give charity. Guy walks up in the street, he says, "Can you help me out?" I say, "I tell you what, my friend, I'll invest in your humanity. I'll give you a quarter." Then he becomes important to me. Two people first get together, they're very focused on each other, they bring each other flowers and presents and candy, and then it sort of like cools a bit, and they each fall down to their natural state, which is 99.9% preoccupied with themselves. Right? And then they're surprised. I don't know what's become of love. Must be the wrong woman. Yeah? Must be the wrong, as opposed to, you have to nurture love. You know how you nurture love? By giving. Give to this person. The love is cooling, give more. Now, in marriage, sex is a very powerful and a wonderful part of what brings two people together. As I say, it's the language of intimacy and of commitment. Now, in Jewish law, I think it's important to say, we're not prudes by any stretch. The Talmud says, in the world to come, you're going to have to give an accounting for every fruit you didn't taste. Yeah, this world is made for our pleasure. Sex is part of that. On Friday night, it's a mitzvah, you're supposed to have a good meal, wear nice clothes, house beautiful. You're married, make love. It's part of what makes gives you a sense of the richness of our lives. It's important to recognize that the greatest pleasure we have as human beings is not by as completely as possible indulging the appetites of the body. A human being is a soul and a body together. They compare the appropriate relationship of soul and body to a person riding a horse. Horse is very powerful. You know, if you have a human being on a horse can go great distances, he's got endurance, speed, and strength. But if you get on a horse, you don't know how to ride it, you need to get thrown. It's going to trample you to death and break your neck. Body's very is our source of strength. It brings vividness and color to our lives. And the goal of life is not to crush it or diminish it or to shut it out. I remember reading in National Geographic a book about that, an article about these monks. So while they're in the monastery and they're eating in total silence, and one person reads them about the evils of gluttony. You know, God forbid they should enjoy their soup. You know, it's like, you know, that's not our way. You're supposed to enjoy this world. The same token, a human being is not just a body. A human being is a soul and a body together. And the greatest pleasure in life is when they are united, which is part of what makes sex holy. But it means it has to be in a way that you don't lose the soul either. Not purely by indulging the appetites. So there's a few things we do that sort of may help us to accomplish that. One is we may try and maintain a sense of tzniut is the Hebrew word. Tzniut means privacy, a sense of dignity, a sense of my own dignity, a sense of the other person's dignity. I don't want to take that from them. On the contrary, I want to nurture them. You know, in Jewish understanding, sex is a way of giving, and it's a man's responsibility to his wife, not vice versa. It's a way in which he gives to her, gives her pleasure, expresses his care for her, his love for her. I'm going to read you a letter. There's a letter written by the Ramban, but about 1,000 years ago, Rabbi writes his son a letter telling him how to make love to his wife. I mean, can you imagine getting such a letter? You know, Dad. I didn't grow up observant. So when I first went to yeshiva, when I went to yeshiva, there was a rabbi that I became very close to, and he said to me, you know, before you get married, come talk to me. So I went to say, he was the head of a large yeshiva in Jerusalem. We go and we sit down. The whole sort of, you know, the study hall and all these learning, and there's the ark and the Torah, and I sit down next to him, and he has a long gray beard. He must have been about 7 years old. Long gray beard. And we sit down, and he starts telling me how to make love to my wife. And I was like, I was so taken aback. I mean, they showed Deep Throat in my high school. You know, it's like, but it was so completely unprurient. It was so graceful. It was so dignified. It was beautiful. And in Jewish understanding, this is part of living. And it's part of what makes our life together rich and pleasurable. And it should be handled that way. It should be dealt with in a way which is with dignity, with a sense of grace, with a sense of generosity and kindness. Anyway, I'm going to read you a letter that the Ramban writes to his son, teaching him how to make love to his wife. So he says, you should begin with words that will draw her heart to you and will settle her mind, will make her happy. To unite your mind with her mind and your intention with her intention. Tell her things which will produce in her a sense of desire and attachment and of love and of willingness and passion. Tell her words which will draw her to a fear of heaven, to a sense of piety. Piety is sort of a word that's gone out of style, but I mean sort of a sense of what is most awesome and precious in life. Tell her of women who had this sense of awe and piety and how they bore proper and pure children. Win her heart with words of charm and seduction and other proper things so that your intent, both of your intent is united for the sake of heaven. Don't have relations while your wife is sleepy because then your minds won't be united. Arouse her instead with pleasing words of desire, as we've explained. In summary, it says, when you're ready to have relations, ensure that your wife's mind agrees with yours. Don't be too hasty to arouse her desires so her mind may be serene. Begin in a pleasing manner of love so that she will be satisfied first. And the editor points out here that in the Jewish understanding, it's a man's responsibility to make sure that his wife is sexually satisfied first. I mean, a man's sexual satisfaction is fairly straightforward and usually tends to take care of itself. So it's saying, you know, you focus on her needs and, you know, don't worry about yourself. You know, this is written 1,000 years ago. You know, the idea that somehow the fact that women are also sexual beings and have needs is a discovery of, you know, late 20th century feminism. I mean, it would be a great surprise to, you know, to Jews. And the truth is, I think that highlights a larger issue, which is, you know, the ties that I got 10 years ago are no longer in fashion. They're much too, they're too wide or too narrow. I don't know, I can't keep up. You know, the pants, I had suits with 2 buttons, now I have 4 buttons. I mean, it's got to throw everything out, get a whole new wear. It's difficult to keep in style. That's only clothes, and all that's at stake is some money and some wasted time. But what if the fashion that you change with is, what does it mean to be a man? What's expected of me as a male? What does it mean to be a woman? What's that about? How do we find each other? How do we create together a way of making a life that will be lasting and stable and real? What if in that we're constantly changing with the fashions? It's very difficult to have any kind of stability in our lives. And this not in the matter of our ties or of how whether our pants have cuffs or how wide our lapels are, but who am I? And when we raise children, well, who are they supposed to be? And what does it mean to be a man or to be a woman? It's very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult. We find ourselves sort of casting about as though adrift for some kind of stability. You know, people remember Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, it's kind of a silly, but it was in some ways a wonderful musical about life in Europe. So one of the first songs there, he says, because of our traditions, every one of us knows who we are and what God expects of us. That's not trivial. Yeah, because to have a framework within which to find ourselves, to locate ourselves, frees us. It doesn't rob us of our individuality and creativity. It frees us to be individual and creative. In other words, in the same way in which if you know the laws of harmony and of counterpoint, you can then improvise. But if you don't have any music, you're just banging around. Jews have thought about men, women, sex, relationships, intimacy, marriage, in a particular way for a long time, 2,000 years at this point. Now, it doesn't mean they're right. It doesn't mean they're right. But it probably means it's worth exploring for at least a week and a half. You know, we're the oldest continuous culture on this earth. And as the divorce rate in the society around us, you know, climbs past 50%, I mean, that's a terrible lot. I mean, I'd hate to get married in that world. So we don't have to. For thousands of years, that our people has been creating lasting, strong, extraordinarily stable and nurturing relationships, which have survived the worst possible kinds every kind of horror you can imagine. I think it suggests not of a certainty that they're right, but it's certainly that, as I say, it's worth exploring.
Thank you for listening to ClassicSinai.com. We hope that you have enjoyed this class. For other free classes, just return to ClassicSinai.com. If you feel that your friends and family would appreciate this class, click on our easy Send to a Friend link. Shalom from the Western Wall.